talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auch die Rollen, Argus, Akhoisa.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, on this, the 300th anniversary of his death, we'll be exploring the life and legacy of the man who made Russia, Peter the Great, and we'll be debating how great he really was. You can email us your thoughts and views, talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. In tonight's show, we're looking at one of the most iconic figures in Russian history, a man who transformed his country, expanded its borders, and remains one of the most controversial leaders of all time. On this, the 300th anniversary of his death, we'll explore how Peter the Great dragged Russia into the modern age, the price he paid for his reforms, and why his legacy is still debated today. And to help me do this, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Professor Judith Devlin is Professor Emerita in Modern History at UCD and is an expert on Russian history, and she's the author of Slavophiles and Commissars, Enemies of Democracy in Modern Russia. Professor Victoria Frieda is Associate Professor of History at the University of California, Berkeley, and is an expert on Imperial Russia, and she's the author of Doubt, Atheism and the 19th Century Russian Intelligentsia. You're both very welcome. And Victoria, I might begin with you. And I suppose debates over Peter the Great today in the 21st century. He's admired by Putin. He's still a divisive and somewhat controversial figure. How should we and how do people view Peter the Great today?
I think, well, I mean, it depends whether you're in Russia, where people admire him enormously, or whether you're abroad, where Peter is remembered as a Europeanizer of Russia. In Russia, people admire him for mostly, I think, for territorial conquests and also for making Russia respected on the international forum, people looking to Russia as a great power. And of course, that makes Westerners uncomfortable, and they prefer to remember Peter as somebody who modernized the alphabet, who secularized Russia, who forced the nobility to wear Western dress, who created a Western-style capital city, St. Petersburg, that for many years people like to visit. So there, you could say that there are two Peters, and the one whom Putin admires these days is very different from any kind of Peter that could be respected in the West. Of course, yeah, the occupation of the Baltic countries by Peter the Great is one example of what worries people in the West today and worries them about Putin's ambitions.
And Victoria, it's interesting the way, you know, people now don't like to talk about the great man in history, but in Peter's case, it probably does apply, where he probably does deserve that title of greatness because he achieved so much and so much was down to him and him alone.
Yes, that's absolutely right. So one of the most miraculous aspects of Peter's reign was his decision to create a navy. So he'd gone to war against the Ottoman Empire and later went to war against Sweden. Russia began those wars without a navy, and Peter constructed a navy, had a navy constructed, but himself learned how to build ships. He traveled to Western Europe, to the Netherlands, and learned himself and forced the nobility, but also Russian craftsmen, to learn to build Western-style naval vessels. So he created a navy out of thin air. He modernized the state, fundamentally revising what old Muscovy and the boyars of old Muscovy into modern-style political servitors. And again, he personally forced the nobility to start to appear not as Orthodox Christians, but as secular Europeans. So when he returned from his first trip to Europe, he arrived and promptly personally cut off the beards of the Russian boyars. Beards were symbols of Orthodox Christianity, and now they were to appear with clean-shaven faces. Peter's also remarkable, though, for his hands-on approach to rule, and I think this is something that really distinguishes him from Putin or from many modern leaders who we would regard as strongmen. So, for example, Peter himself created the modern secular alphabet for Russia. He created typeface for that alphabet. He was constantly involved in doing things like visiting anatomical theaters. He would turn up at people's houses when he heard that they had sore teeth, and he would pull the teeth out of their mouths. And it makes him sound a little bit pathological. He was very restless, constantly turning up, trying to ensure that people were following the law. He himself was on the military front. He loved battle. He was on the battlefield for years. And this kind of personal involvement, often intimidating involvement for many of the military commanders and administrators under him, is very different from modern leaders who sit behind desks in their closed walls. You know, Putin, not very often, or when he's viewed in public, only in a very curated manner. So very unlike Peter, who's just constantly in the thick of things, intimidating people, but also commanding them, and thereby able to institute fundamental change.
Judith, Putin admires Peter the Great, but so too did Stalin. And it's interesting, the fan club he had among later Russian leaders.
Yeah, I mean, it is... It's famously the case that Stalin rather fancied himself as fundamentally as a great state builder. And it's in that sense that Stalin admired Peter. And of course, there were films, a famous novel by Alexei Tolstoy about Peter, and in which Stalin took a deep personal interest. Of course, the ruler that he most admired was Ivan the Terrible, and that all ended up very awkwardly for Eisenstein. That's a separate story. But certainly rulers, it is interesting, though, that rulers like to look back at figures in history and then project onto them their own preoccupations. And certainly, of course, because Peter was such a very fundamental figure in Russian history, did change its course. That's one of the reasons why, of course, I suppose a Putin or a Stalin would look back. It's you know, ego building for them. I'm a great, you know, state builder. And as Victoria was saying, that's doubtless why Putin admires him today. And there is a sort of cult of Putin, I think, or at least there is a cult of Putin too, but there's also one, it incorporates sort of Peter to some extent as well.
And there are those debates, Judith, about whether he was a moderniser, an autocrat, whether we should view him as a tyrant and despot or as one of these enlightened rulers. And it's possible that he was a combination of many of these different types of leaders.
It's true in a sense that he wasn't, let's say, the enlightened despot, as one might say Catherine the Great was, or Joseph II, for example, in Austria. Although, of course, he did have a vision of Russia, and that was to modernize Russia and to strengthen it, as Victoria was saying, and to build up the state, its navy, its military prowess, and the actual extent of the state. But why I suppose we see him as this great change of Russia, the man who affects an enormous transformation of Russia, is because he opens it, of course, to the West. There was the old Russia, which was a very different place. And then he forcibly and very brutally, in a sense, in terms of modernized it, opened it to the West, which meant, in effect, Europeanizing its cultural norms. It applied, one thing we should say apropos of this, though, and remember, that applied only to the elites. It didn't touch the peasantry at all. And of course, you had therefore, and only to a limited extent, townspeople, merchants, etc. So what Peter introduced was not only this enormous transformation of the state, building it up to be like a modern European state, insisting that his elites live, dress, etc., like modern Europeans, but he also created this famous break between the educated elites and the mass of the Russian population, something that was deeply controversial from the late 18th and especially 19th century, right up to the present day, basically. I mean, we can see echoes of it going right down almost to the present. And it's much debated and a very interesting question, really, I suppose one might say.
And Judith, you've mentioned the old Russia. What did the old Russia look like before Peter began to change it?
You know, there's one of the names for, you know, Holy Rus. A fundamental thing to bear in mind is that its culture was shaped fundamentally by the church, so the Orthodox, Russian Orthodox Church, was a major sort of political power. But it also framed cultural life. And attitudes to the West were radically different from those espoused by Peter. Fundamentally, the West was seen as a sort of heretics, therefore a source of contamination. There have been debates about Western influences in later 17th century Russia, and they existed. But it's interesting to see that, I mean, there were Westerners there. Some of them were helping things like army modernization even in the 17th century, but they were confined from the 1650s in Moscow, for example, to a particular area, what they call them, sort of like the German or the Nemetska area, a little village, basically, or a little town. And they were kind of cut off. The Russians weren't meant to mix with them. Another thing, so they were seen as a sort of bad influence. Tobacco was the work of the devil. Shaving was bad. And this is one of the reasons Victoria alludes to the fact that when he comes back from the Grand Embassy, that the very next day he takes some of the warriors whom he actually come to greet him in their kaftans. Remember, they were wearing kaftans, etc. And they're bearded, because Orthodox had to be bearded. It was correct to be bearded. To be shaven was to be a kind of heretic. And he cuts off their beards. It was an appalling cultural shock. And you know, deep disrespect to these high noblemen, the boyars. So tobacco was sort of banned. It was seen as the devil's work. Another aspect of Russia that's worth thinking about, the old Russia, is the position of women, because this is also going to change. Women were secluded. They lived in the terem. Only priests, their immediate family, for example, or ladies-in-wait, etc., could visit them. If they went to church, there was a sort of curtained-off area where they went. What they wore was also, wasn't at all revealing. They were covered up, only hands, necks, etc., could be seen. So women had, in this sense, in a cultural sense of quite restricted life, total absence of secular culture. If you can think of it, there were no schools, there were no universities, there were no arts in the modern sense. Secular, well, there were icon paintings, so it was religious. There was ecclesiastical church music, but there wasn't secular instrumental music. None of that exists. It's very hard to get our heads around. The church controlled the only printing press in Moscow, and it's reckoned that it produced only about 10 books that were not wholly religious in the entire 17th century. And we'll see that changes in the 18th century. So it changes under Peter. It's Peter who breaks that all open. So the old Russia was a sort of, it wouldn't be correct to say it was a theocracy, but it was the culture of old Russia was fundamentally shaped by the church.
And that kind of goes back to then that story about the cutting of the beards. And I wonder, what point was Peter making by the cutting of the beards? Was he saying, I don't like the way you look in your old-fashioned clothes and your old-fashioned idea of having these beards. I want you to modernize. I want you to look different. Or was it just that he wanted to insult them? Or was it that he was demanding that they modernize their beliefs? Was it an attack on the religious practices or just the way they looked?
One thing to bear in mind is that Peter didn't break away the church, didn't ruin the church. I mean, he kept the church, he needed the church, he actually believed to some extent. He was also deeply, deeply, I mean, he went in for, I'm interested to hear Victoria's views on this, but, you know, that he went in for all sorts of pranks, for irreverent kind of ceremonies, really very crude joking that sort of undermined a lot of customs, etc., and lots of drunken, you know, behaviour and vandalism, in a sense. So that's part of Peter. What lies behind it, I'm not so sure. And certainly what he wanted to say is, that's an end to walking around in kaftans and wearing beards. You're going to be modern. And to be modern means you shave your beards. And of course, then a decree is introduced which forces townspeople, and especially the nobility, to wear modern European dress. So hitherto, they've been, you know, you can think of, and I can look at portraits or even famous 19th century paintings, or 20th century paintings, Golovin, for example, of Shalyapin as Ivan the Terrible. I'm sure you know that painting. You know, he's in this beautiful brocade kaftan. And, you know, so he looks totally oriental. Fundamentally, they look as though, you know, they could be, it looks oriental. Well, Peter was having none of that. No, you're going to wear the silk breeches, the stockings, you're going to wear a wig, you know, the white powdered wigs. They hated that. Most of them hated having to do that. And, you know, we could talk about what happens. And finally, one moment in particular, I think, that sort of symbolises the great change. He changes the calendar. And hitherto, the calendar, I think, being dated to the, you know, the God's creation of the earth. And I was trying to calculate the other day, and I think it might be, according to the Orthodox year calendar, the year started in September, when God was supposed to have made the world in autumn. And it was the year something like 7028. And on the 1st of January, 1700, Peter just introduces the Julian calendar. He says, no, it's the 1st of January, 1700. And in a sense, it's, you're in a new era. This is a new time, and we're going to have a new culture to go with it. And I think that's sort of, and of course, then the other thing, very shortly afterwards in the territory conquered in his northern wars, he found St. Petersburg. Then that's going to be the new capital, the new site of the new culture.
So he's got to reshape the calendar year. He's got to reshape what Russia looks like. He's got to reshape the boundaries. He's got to reshape the culture. Maybe, Victoria, we should go back in time then to his birth in 1672. And I wonder, can you explain to us how he came to power and the circumstances there? Because it's kind of confusing. He shared the throne with his half-brother Ivan the Fifth for a time up until 1696. While he was a child, his mother seems to have been a huge influence and was quite literally the power behind the throne for a time, whispering instructions from behind the throne. And it is a kind of a complicated early life.
Oh boy, was it ever. Yeah, so his father, Alexei, had started reforms. So he had started trying to modernize the army, started bringing in Western advisors, he died early, and he had two wives. There were the Miloslavskis, which was his first family, with whose wife had many children, but no viable male offspring. So there was his older brother, Fyodor, and then Ivan, and both of Fyodor and Ivan were disabled. But they were the older claimants to the throne and the first line. And then there were the Naryshkins. And the Naryshkins were also boyar, from a boyar, but they were also boyars. And they had a more westernizing tendency than the Miloslavskis did. And all of the Russian boyars who were worried about Alexei's tendency to want to modernize Russia were very nervous about whether the Miloslavskis would maintain dominance or whether the Naryshkins would come to power. And there was actually street fighting in Moscow over the claimants to the throne. And so Peter had to be half tsar together with his half-brother Ivan. Ivan, then being disabled, was largely in charge of sitting in church and presiding over religious ceremonies and receiving ambassadors, while Peter was very restless. And then he was sent off to a family estate called Priabruzhenskoye, where he was given toy cannons to play with, and then a group of young men to play with, whom he made to play soldiers. And that was the beginning of his first Western-style regiment, because some of the people who came to play with him in his toy regiment were foreigners, Scotsmen, Dutch, Germans, French, kind of mercenaries or adventurers who joined him and who showed him Western military technology, which he was very interested in developing. And before you knew it, he had this basically a small army in this little village of Priabruzhenskoye, where, and the Miloslavskis are sitting in the Kremlin, getting increasingly nervous about this very uppity and rambunctious Peter. And then there's a conflict between them. And Peter at first flees. He's worried for his life. But then the townspeople or the boyars side with the Naryshkins. And Peter comes back, and this is part of his conviction that in order to overcome factionalism, infighting among boyars, and consolidate the Muscovite or later Russian state, one needs westernization. And then another perspective on that practice of the beard shaving and his hostility towards boyars is that reforms became a package. You couldn't do one without the others. And there was something, I think, for these old boyars very disorienting about the Western army. Protestants at court, shaving beards, Western-style clothing, women who are asked to appear alongside men at festivities. And it's disorienting, I think, intentionally, that they can't fall back on their own ways. They can't fall back on their own style, their own style of dress, their old style houses, their old style ways of enjoying meals together, religious rituals. Peter's trying to take them out of their comfort zone. He brings them to St. Petersburg in the 1700s. He wants them to feel out of their element so that he can force them to comply with his new idea of a state, of a Russian state, a Russian state that's not a patrimonial state, not just tied to the idea of the Orthodox Tsar with its Byzantine legacy, but to the idea of a state as an entity in its own right. So it's a new model of rule, and he wanted people to be loyal to him. Of course, many people hated him, and as Judith said, they viewed him as the Antichrist. So Peter was also somebody who demanded enormous sacrifices of boyars, his constant war. The Great Northern War lasted 21 years of his reign. Tens of thousands of people, soldiers, died in the war. Tens of thousands of people died creating his new city of St. Petersburg, which he built in a swamp. And so there's personal hatred and resentment of Peter for demanding these reforms. And the way that he overcomes this resistance is by creating a world in which people don't recognize themselves, in which if they look in a mirror, which was itself an innovation in Russia at the time, they wouldn't know who they were seeing. And what they saw was something that was loathsome to their own religious upbringing. So the military reforms and the political reforms and the cultural reforms are part of a big piece that allows Peter to orchestrate a new kind of state. And then one big difference between him and this hatred of the people for him and his indifference to their hatred of him that makes him not enlightened is that in the Enlightenment in the 18th century, increasingly, rulers think or are told and writers believe that the ruler rules in the name of the good of the people, of the common good. And for the flourishing of the society and of the citizenry as a whole. This didn't concern Peter particularly. He cared about Russia's greatness. He didn't mind that tens of thousands of people died. That was very different than Catherine the Great, who came later, who was very, very concerned about her public reputation, what Europeans had to say about how she cared for the Russian population. It doesn't mean that she was a humanitarian, feel-good, soft kind of woman, but she was worried about what other people thought about the way that she treated the civilian public. And for Peter the Great, this was not really a concern. He believed that people should sacrifice, and that was his first and primary message to his population.
And Victoria, another thing, in terms of the change from being Tsar of Russia to Emperor of Russia, he becomes Tsar, I think, just before his 10th birthday. And then around the time of his 50th birthday, he decides to become Emperor. What does that actually mean?
It's a claim to a title. So the Holy Roman Emperor was the most prestigious and the most honored title in Europe of all of the monarchs. And Peter wanted a title that would make him not a Tsar, who might be somebody disregarded in the pecking order of European diplomacy, but wanted a title on par with the most prestigious of European rulers. And so he claimed this title for himself in 1721, at the end of the war, of the Great Northern War, having defeated Charles XII, who was considered at that time to be the invincible, one of the most powerful European monarchs. And he tries to force other European monarchs to recognize this title by signing missives with this. He had already started using the title in 1709 after the Battle of Poltava. The Great Northern War had originally, so the Great Northern War started in 1700, had originally gone incredibly badly for Russia. So Peter had lost battle after battle against Charles XII, really humiliating defeats. And his first big victory had come in Ukraine, in the city of Poltava, in 1709. And it was at that point that he saw a potential turning point in the war and a potential point for really getting European recognition of Russia as or Muscovy still at this point, as a territory that was capable of standing up to one of the greatest military forces in Europe. And so he then cashes in on this recognition in 1721, and indeed many Western commentators thought that it was a miracle that Peter managed to prevail over Sweden. Sweden did, in fact, pose a threat to northern European states in the early 18th century. And so he's using this clout to proclaim himself emperor and simultaneously to rename Muscovy into the Russian Empire. So it's only with Peter as emperor in 1721 that Russia adopts that name and demands to be called Russia and not Muscovy, recognizing also the new capital city of St. Petersburg with its position on the Baltic, open to sea routes, open to maritime trade, possessing a navy, and much more closely tied to European politics than it had ever been before. With the title, of course, Peter's also trying to marry his daughters into European royalty. So he really sees himself as creating a dynastic claim for Russia as a great European monarchic dynasty.
And Victoria, this imperial claim goes all the way up to the end of the reign of Nicholas II. And I'm wondering, why do we still call Nicholas II Tsar Nicholas II if the tsardom has been replaced by this empire and this new imperial title?
Well, I think it goes back to what Judith was saying about the sense that Russia lost its cultural identity when Peter the Great reformed Russia. He created a Western nobility, and in the 18th century, as they were trying to establish their clout in Europe, they didn't really mind having cast off the folkways of the Russian people. They weren't embarrassed to have lost their connection to the external symbols of orthodoxy. But in the 19th century, as nationalism grew, Russians began to feel that they had nothing to offer Europe as a unique culture, as a culture that demanded respect or admiration qua Russian. Of course, the Russian Empire was a multi-ethnic empire, and the more it grew, the more nationalities belonged to it. So that by 1800, you have Muslims, you have Jews inhabiting the Russian Empire, you have animists, you have Buddhists. So it wasn't in the 19th century anymore a uniquely Russian, it wasn't a nation, it wasn't uniquely Russian. Russians, in fact, made up less than 50% of the population of the Russian Empire in the 19th century. And yet the political elites are yearning, they're hankering back to this time when they could point us at something, when men were men and trees stood in the ground, the old cliche of the Russian mujik, the Russian man. And as time went on, and there were modernization meant democratization, technological reform, capitalism. The Romanov monarchs, Nicholas II in particular, thought that they could only maintain autocracy, that is autocratic rule without democracy, by hearkening back to what they called the ancient Russian traditions, the ancient traditions of Muscovy, when ostensibly all ordinary people were Orthodox Christians, and as Orthodox Christians, ostensibly, they all supported autocracy. And so Nicholas II really began to cultivate this image of himself as a pre-Petrine czar and wanted people to recognize him in that way. So the empire, of course, cuts two ways. It's one is that it's a symbol of prestige, but it's a symbol of prestige in which all players, whether it be England or France or Russia, compete for territories, for technology, for overseas colonies, and this is a competition that you can measure in square mileage of how many new lands you occupy. But if there's nothing special that you can say makes your country unique or worthy of respect, then it's a kind of an empty game. And I think that Russians felt in the late 19th century that this had been an empty game.
Well, tonight we are debating the life and legacy of Peter the Great. We're going to take a quick break now, but when we come back, we'll be talking about wars, westernization, and what Peter actually looked like. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history, and tonight we're debating the life and legacy of Peter the Great on this, the 300th anniversary of his death. I'm rejoined by my brilliant panel, Professor Judith Devlin, Professor Emerita in Modern History at UCD, and Professor Victoria Frieda, Associate Professor of History at the University of California, Berkeley. Victoria, can I ask you what Peter looked like? Because he seemed to have been quite a tall man, a big man, and that his physical size seems to have had a big impact as well.
Peter the Great was physically intimidating. He was 6'7" tall, making him enormous in size for that age, literally head and shoulders above ordinary Russians, but above Western Europeans as well. So when he came into a room, everybody saw him. He was also a slightly strange-looking man. Because of his height, his head seemed to be a little bit smaller than it ought to be. People commented that his feet and hands were very small. And after the political disorders and the brutality of the 1690s, he seemed to have emerged from his childhood with strange physical tics, so that he often had contorted facial features. He would have physical kind of convulsions. And when he became angry, when people didn't follow his commands, when he suspected that somebody was being disloyal to him, these physical tics and convulsions would become more pronounced. So that when he was having an argument with boyars, they really became physically terrified. And ironically, it was only a woman, his concubine, and then later wife Catherine, who wasn't afraid to be in the room with him when he was in a rage, and would often be called for. They would call for her to come and sit with him and talk him down from whatever the object of his rage was. And she became a kind of an intercessor to make sure that he didn't randomly imprison people, beat them, physically punish them. So, yes, he was an intimidating person and really struck the fear of God or the fear of himself into people.
And how do you explain that volatility and unpredictability? I can understand why he was so terrifying for people around him, because you couldn't predict what he might do next. And it certainly makes it dangerous to be around him.
Yeah, I think that the 18th century and the late 17th century were a very violent period. So if you just consider folkways or the life of the military, people killed each other. The uprising of the Streltsy is one good example. So the Streltsy had been a musketeer force living in the Kremlin, serving as the bodyguards of the Romanov Tsars. They had originally been equipped with Western-style muskets, but in the 17th century, as those muskets became outdated, Alexei, Peter's father, had the idea of modernizing the military technologies. And the Streltsy became outdated and began to mutiny, worrying that they would be sent to become serfs or ordinary peasants. So they mutinied, and these mutinies were dangerous. And Peter put down one of these mutinies in the most brutal fashion. So this occurred, one of these mutinies occurred while he was on his European tour, the Grand Embassy, and he came back. So this is the same time that he's cutting off the boyars' beards, organizes a massive interrogation trial and has men interrogated in the center of Muscovy and in the Kremlin, next to the Kremlin. He wants everybody in Moscow to see these men being flogged and burned and hanged. He needed to show his power. Some people say he was cruel and extremely cruel or even bloodthirsty. But this violence was actually typical and almost the norm for early modern Europe. Similar example is the Navy. One of the first naval ships that Peter built was painted in red on the inside of the ship because he knew that naval vessels used for battle became so covered and drenched in blood that no person would voluntarily step on board one who wasn't already in the Navy. So he painted the boat red so that people couldn't see the blood stains on the planks just to get them on board. And again, this is not Peter's invention. Wars were extremely bloody. But torture and bloodshed were normal events in Europe in the late 17th century and early 18th century. And again, this is what's special about the Enlightenment, that Enlightenment thinkers came to question when should apply torture, whether one should ever apply torture, and eventually came out arguing against the death penalty and against any application of torture. Some also came out arguing against war and advocating pacifism. But in Peter's age, this was totally irregular. So the idea that you would physically intimidate people was actually more normal. Peter also had other ways of intimidating people, for example, by drinking. He could drink pretty much any man under the table. He also drank with women. And one of the ways in which he punished members of the nobility or boyars who didn't comply was by alcohol forfeits. So he would lock people in a room with a barrel of vodka, telling them that they weren't allowed to leave until they had finished their vodka. And some people died. They couldn't take that amount of vodka, and they died of vodka, of alcohol poisoning. But he made women and men drink with him to the point of absolute surfeit. And being a tall man, he could simply hold his alcohol better than other people. So next time you're in a pub, think about that. Be glad you're not drinking with Peter.
Judith, be glad you're not drinking with Peter, indeed. And when we talk about the westernization of Russia and we talk about the Cultural Revolution that he inaugurated, how dramatic, Judith, were those changes?
Well, yes, they were dramatic. You know, some historians have pointed out that in many ways they were quite superficial. You know, so if you're talking about provincial nobility, etc., or people living on their estates, many of them very poor. But they were sort of, he inaugurated what were incremental changes. So if we even think of St. Petersburg, which became the seat of government around 1710 or so, and to which then, as Victoria was saying, the nobility, at least about 1,000 nobles or so, were forced to move there in 1714. And then they have to go and live this kind of new life there. You know, remember, you know, so people are now, they're mixing. Men and women are going to social events together. They go to balls together. They have dinners together. This whole social life, which hitherto would have been inconceivable. And for women who had in the past been really modest, now they were meant to dress like, you know, modern European women in, you know, décolleté dresses and all the rest of it. And they had you know, etiquette manuals were quite popular to show people how you're actually meant to behave. But in terms of the inculcation of these norms, that's something that goes on over time. And it's been much debated. One famous historian, well, one has sort of said, oh, well, you know, and a very common view is that this simply created a gulf between the educated elites and the people. Expressed in the fact that educated Russians spoke and used Russian. Pushkin, for example, the great poet Pushkin, wrote to his wife in French. Benkendorf, the head of the third section in the 19th century, writes memos in obviously German accent, well, in French, but reflecting the fact that his accent must have been quite German, in fact, it was Baltic German. But So you know, this Nabokov's family, Nabokov, I think, remembers, you know, also that the family used French. You think, how bizarre. So according to one line of thought on this, this creates this deep alienation between the educated elite and the masses. And it's certainly an idea that's taken up in the sort of the early to mid 19th century, where there's great debate about the so-called Slavophile controversy. But also then there's the other takes, which are somewhat more, you know, others have thought, oh, well, was the Russian noble alien, an alien, a foreigner in his own country. But a rather more interesting idea, and more to my mind plausible, is that the Russians were sort of culturally bilingual. Basically, they could navigate between these worlds. That was all one. And certainly from the kind of in the period where we see the start of nationalism, indeed, or, you know, like in the late 18th century, that's also beginning in Moscow. This is the first time you're actually beginning to get private press. Moscow becomes the site of intellectuals who are quite alienated, dislike the court life, but they're highly educated, working in the world of Catherine. Victoria's talked about Catherine, a completely different type of ruler, basically. Many respects, very different. Although she completes and develops on Peter's policies and his Europeanization, modernization, the great, you know, her correspondence with Diderot, etc. But so Russia certainly continues to change, but a sort of debate about how beneficial that change is develops. It's beginning in the early 18th century, and what really kind of gives it more impetus is, of course, the war with Napoleon, which brings in, as you might expect, a kind of nationalist reaction. And then in the 1830s and 40s, has Russia, as one critic put it, contributed absolutely nothing to world history? It's a blank spot. Alone in the world, we have given it nothing, etc., etc. So this famous philosophical letter caused a complete outcry. And the Tsar of the time, Nicholas I, he closed the publication. The letter, actually, this denunciation was written in French, published in French. Interestingly, the author is ultimately declared mad and visited, you know, subject to house arrest and visited by the chief of police and a doctor, sort of on a regular basis to report back, and eventually pens an apology of a madman. And then in that he sort of says, "Oh, Peter did great things for us." But that was a very controversial account, and it produces Moscow is the site of the kind of more nationalist or proto-nationalist viewpoint. The Moscow kind of gentry come back and say, on the contrary, we, you know, look at the West, look at capitalism, look at this grasping individualism, the miseries of capitalism, the greed on show, the disputatious parliament, this individualism and squabbling embodied in these awful parliaments. We don't want to go down that road. And Russians are communitarian as opposed to the individualistic and grasping West. And that's a take that we can even see, it echoes down. Sakharov, you know, and Sakharov, who espouses, you know, in the 1960s, is writing for, we need to kind of develop the sort of institutions, legal and political culture that we see in the West. And Solzhenitsyn, the great writer, takes a completely different view of this, you know, which is, no, Russia should retreat up to, you know, sort of a few provinces up in the north and be free of this contamination and concentrate on spiritual development, etc. And simultaneously, it's quite interesting that we have kind of neo-Stalinists and the intelligentsia who sort of say, look, no, Russians are communitarian and communism absolutely suits us, or the Soviet socialism suits us. And one of their critics is Alexander Yakovlev, who at that stage is working in Agitprop, and who's actually kind of sanctioned and sent off as a punishment to be ambassador to Canada. So, I mean, it's a sort of debate about what is Russian identity? Who are the Russians? Are they like other Europeans? Or are they different? And in a sense, I think we can see that. I mean, in the 1990s, we have these thoughts going again. And in a way, I think that Putin is kind of playing into that that way of looking at Russian history. It's a question of identity. And why should we be expected to copy Western norms? They don't work in Russia. Look at the 1990s.
Yes, I was wondering about that, a kind of a backlash against Westernization, because, and you've taken the story brilliantly right up to the present day. So why does Putin then still admire Peter if he thinks he was a great leader, but he opposes this whole aping of the West and the belief that we should copy the way the Westerners do it, because his approach is very different when it comes to the West?
Well, I think it's what Victoria was saying. I mean, Peter was not a Democrat. He was, and like Stalin, it's this idea of the state builder. And to have a strong state, you need to have power concentrated in the hands of de facto the autocrat, who sees further, understands better, and of course, in Putin's case, can also read history, than his famous take on history. So, I mean, in a sense, Peter is admired not because he introduces Western culture. He's admired because he modernizes the state and makes it more efficient.
And Victoria, the Westernization helped the military as well, and it helped his plans for expansion and increasing the size of the country. And so much of it depended on the wars he got involved in.
Yes, that's right. Although there's an interrelationship between the wars that he got involved in and the political development of Russia. So, for example, Peter the Great instituted a Senate. So this was the first body that was allowed to make decisions, political decisions, in the absence of the Tsar. This is in 1711, where he appointed his trusted associates to basically run the country while he was off on the battlefield fighting wars, so that the business of the state didn't become paralyzed. He created the first European-style bureaucracy when he created the so-called colleges in 1717. He was very interested in taxes. He desperately needed money, and so he created a poll tax in 1724. This was the idea that every single male in Russia needed to pay a flat fee as a member of the state. He said, money is the artery of war. Part of the reason for creating the Senate and for creating these colleges is to surveil the population, to harness the wealth of the country in order to pay for mercenaries, for soldiers, for cannons, for equipment, feeding the troops. He desperately needed money, and in order to get that money, he needed to surveil the population. He instituted passports for the first time in 1722. The war, yes, there are defeats and there are new fortification styles that are built. St. Petersburg was built as a fortress, even though it was never besieged apart from once in the very beginning of the war. But the physical modernization of the country, the idea that Russia is going to be a great military power, is part and parcel of its political modernization as well. So, yeah, to quote some of the highlights of the war, you have the Battle of Narva, almost at the outset of the war, where something like 8,000 to 10,000 Russians are killed on Peter's side almost immediately by Charles XII's troops, because Russia didn't have a modernized army. It had boyars who came into the field with men that they picked up on their estates, who fought for them personally. There was no hierarchy between them, no military rank and order. Boyars always wanted to believe that they were the first in rank. So try giving commands or having boyars obey each other's commands in a coordinated military movement. And then try to get these old style boyars, whose beards have not yet been or have just been freshly cut, to cooperate with Western mercenaries using Western military techniques. So the other prong of Peter's wars was to get these boyars to behave like Western style military commanders, obeying, learning ballistics, learning artillery, learning the mathematics necessary to use cannon according to the new techniques, adopting new technologies, rifles, infantry formations. And this is the same, it's similar to the bureaucracy, in that you need a rank and a hierarchy of command. And so he's instilling this rank and hierarchy on both sides of the administration and in the officer corps. And he's forcing these old boyars to become what we might see as interchangeable pieces of a clockwork, reliable servitors who know the rules, obey them, and don't follow their own, don't pursue their own interests, and don't follow their own whims. So this is a kind of a disciplining of the nobility, a subjugation of the nobility to become reliable servants of the state. He constantly uses this phrase, servants of the state.
Well, tonight we are talking about the life and legacy of Peter the Great. We're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll be finding out about the death of Peter 300 years ago this month. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history, and tonight we are debating the life and legacy of Peter the Great. Victoria, can we talk about the death of Peter then in 1725? And I suppose the changes that he introduced in the lead up to that, because he didn't have an obvious successor, so he introduced a few years earlier this table of ranks, where he was kind of creating a kind of a hierarchy almost for the entire country in terms of their position and status. And it was a kind of a change that reverberated long after his death.
Oh, absolutely. He had his oldest son killed This is Alexei, the heir to the throne, believing that he had other male offspring who could become claimants to the throne. He had killed his oldest son, who was a kind of a wayward son, not interested in military technologies, not interested in being on the battlefield, actually rather afraid of being on the battlefield. And this son and Peter the Great became increasingly estranged. And Peter went so far as to call him a gangrened limb. And at some point, Alexis became so afraid of his father that he fled abroad. He fled to Vienna and was then hidden in some castle, I think, on Italian territory, as he negotiated, or eventually negotiated, a return with Peter, and was then tortured by Peter's associates, by high-ranking statesmen, boyars. And so Peter, in 1718, when his oldest son died, was without an heir. And he decided instead that he was going to create a system whereby the Tsar, the emperor, could appoint his successor. And this was part of his ethic of meritocracy, that a man should have the skills and the discipline, the work habits that would make him worthy of being an emperor. So this is what Peter said, but himself never appointed a successor, as a result of which his second wife, Catherine, became empress. Catherine had been war booty. She had been seized in Sweden during the Great Northern War. She had become the concubine of one of Peter the Great's closest associates, a man by the name of Menshikov. So Menshikov took Catherine as a concubine and then gifted her to Peter. She was often with Peter on the battlefield. In some ways, she was the son that Peter the Great never had, but she was also his lover. Famously, also unfaithful to Peter. And for a while, it wasn't clear who was going to succeed him. But his westernized associates were very, very afraid that if he died, and if a conservative conservative member of the Romanov family was to succeed Peter, all of his reforms would be undone, but more particularly, there might be revenge against them personally from all of the people who thought that Peter was the Antichrist, that his westernizing reforms were against the Orthodox spirit, people who had personally suffered under Peter's rule. So there was a big movement to appoint Catherine. Still debated whether Catherine could read Peter's letters that he sent her, whether she knew how to write. In any case, they appoint her as a kind of a puppet. Menshikov in particular chooses her, thinking that he can maintain power in this way. And as a result of this choice, Menshikov being in favor of the westernizing reforms, Catherine playing along with these westernizing reforms, the westernizing drive of Russia was preserved. And the 18th century becomes known as the era of palace coups because of this instability created by Peter.
Judith, we began the show talking about how Peter is viewed differently in Russia than outside of Russia. But what's really emerged from the discussion is that there are different aspects of his life and career that are celebrated in Russia, different to the ones that are maybe respected and valued outside of Russia. And then he's probably condemned and criticized for different things inside of Russia than he is outside of Russia. So it is very much a mixed legacy.
Well, yes, I think you couldn't deny that. I think it's much easier to admire Peter from a distance. So in the sense that if you go to visit Petersburg as a tourist and wander around its streets, you can't help but being struck by the beauty, the architectural beauty of the place. You will always feel a certain debt to Peter, of course, because he comes out of the changes that he wrought. But he's certainly a man of conflicted legacy. He created modern Russia.
My thanks to Professor Judith Devlin, Professor Emerita in Modern History at UCD, Professor Victoria Frieda, Associate Professor of History at the University of California, Berkeley. And that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer, Marisa Sullivan, and Peter Malloy on sound. We've got more debate and discussion next week, so I hope you can join us then. We've been Talking History. Good night.